Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We're proud to say that BetDSI have rejoined us once again as one of our keynote sponsors on 3 yards per carry. We welcome them and we welcome you to join up with them. The NFL season obviously kicks off at the weekend. The college football season has just got underway, but it's not just limited to football. There are a myriad of other sports out there that you could bet on. There's entertainment things, there's politics things at BetDSI.com. They have a great app. I've used it myself. I know the boys have used it too. They have a great mobile interface. And you know, this year you can get 101% match bonus on your first deposit of up to $1,000. That's 101% match bonus on your first deposit of up to $1,000. Use the code YARDS101. As always, YARDS101. BetDSI for all of your betting needs and other ones that you probably didn't even know existed. YARDS101 with BetDSI.
Welcome to 3 yards per carry, a podcast covering the Miami Dolphins and the NFL. Now, here's your hosts, Chris, Alf, and Simon.
And we're on, and welcome to another edition of 3 yards per carry. I'm Alfredo Arteaga. Simon Clancy is here. Chris Kaufman is here. And I guess we could get into it right away. So, Simon, how many games do you have the Dolphins winning? 8 or 9?
Lead in with that
Super Bowl or bust, right?
Yeah. I'm expecting the playoffs now.
Only 3 games out.
3 games out of the playoffs is hilarious.
Yes.
I mean, the scary reality is now that actually they're probably gonna win 5 games. Yeah. I mean, I can't see them. I mean, I think they'll beat the Bengals and the Giants, and they'll, you know, the Jets on the road is a pick'em game. I think they'll win 4 or 5 games. Which
can I take issue with you on the Giants?
Annoying.
I'll tell you why. Daniel Jones, Saquon Barkley, you don't think they scored too much for us?
Did you see Saquon's
still bad?
Saquon's stats? Yeah, did you see his stats yesterday, Saquon? He had 2.4 inches per carry.
Yeah, I know. I have him on fantasy.
13 carries for 1 yard. I mean, he's a great player, but come on, it's the Jets, not the 85 Bears.
I changed my team name from the Wrath of Quan to My Dalvins after that.
No, there's a player.
Yes.
Yes.
Because I do have Dalvin. I just want to boast that for a second.
He is a serious downhill runner.
Oh, man. So good.
Yeah. And I think
when he gets rolling, he's tough to
stop. All three of us had Dalvin over Fournette that draft.
Mm, so. Definitely.
Well, we were just in love with Dalvin that year. I mean,
yeah.
Such a player.
So, yeah. So, Simon, distress, really. So, you really do see 5 wins here. Wow.
I mean, look, I mean, the coaching job that's being done is phenomenal. I mean, Chris and I were talking yesterday about the XFL, what positions were essentially XFL lineups, position groups. And it's an offensive line. Yeah. Running back and defense, the defensive backfield. You look at that defensive backfield that started. It was heinous. And yet, they're getting terrific play out of Nick Needham, you know, who looks an absolute, but it's true. We laugh.
It's true.
He looked an absolute liability in the preseason and early in the season. I mean, I saw the numbers on him today. It's something like in the last 2 games, he's had like 2 interceptions, 2 sacks, a forced fumble, 4 pass breakups and 14 tackles or something. It's ridiculous. He's playing at a really high level. Look at Eric Rowe, all of a sudden reborn as a safety, playing really well, a tight end eliminator.
Since the bye week.
This Stephen Parker kid comes up with an absolutely phenomenal interception in the end zone to essentially change the game.
Changed him into a box safety for this game and played him for the first time in a little bit. He had been a free safety before, and that experiment wasn't working so well.
Look at the schemes that they're playing. I mean, a number of times on the first possession, first play of a Colts drive, they were playing 6 defensive backs, 7 defensive backs. I mean, it was remarkable to see that, you know, I'm kind of flabbergasted by the job that he's doing. And somebody made a really good point on social media on that, on the 3 yards per carry account today, when we were talking about sort of draft and coaches and that sort of thing. And somebody said, I'd much rather have the fourth pick and Brian Flores than Zach Taylor in the first pick. And I kind of feel like that's an interesting... Because I personally am of the opinion that we still have the ammunition and the ability to get to it if that's who we want. So as disappointing as it is to win, because it the margin of uncertainty is bigger, I'm still not massively concerned. And the flip side to that is that the coaching job that's being done by Flores and his coaches is pretty astounding.
Well, you're not going to be disappointed when they're playing in the AFC Championship game this year, Simon.
No, I think that's inevitable at this point.
Yeah, let me say.
All you have to do is look at a graph.
Yeah, they keep trending that way.
They're going to be winning by 40 points in like 4 weeks.
They're going to absolutely murder everybody in the playoffs by 40 points. At one point, my friends kind of consider me like kind of an encyclopedia because I kind of know every single player on the team. At one point, my friend, who's a Cowboy fan and has some connections, asked me, that Ken Crawley guy, he's kind of bendy. I like the way he moves. Where did you guys get him? And I said, I don't know who the hell that guy is.
Ken Crawley?
Yeah.
He was really good for the Saints for a while.
I don't know when the hell we got him. When the hell did we get him? Like, what?
We just picked him up off waivers.
Yeah, he falls into that category of, what was the cornerback who was really good for a couple of seasons and then got injured and went to the CFL, played at Hamilton. I've got his phone number. It begins with D. His first name begins with D. Anyway, I'll think of it while you carry on the conversation. But yeah, he's that kind of guy. He's just somebody that's emerged from, and like you say, played really well with the Saints, and then all of a sudden just shows up on the roster. It is.
He played like 700 snaps. He played like 1,000 snaps just a couple of years ago with the Saints. I mean, he was a starter.
Delvin Brown.
Delvin Brown. Wasn't he also on the Saints?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, exactly. He was another one of those kind of reclamation projects. He had a couple of really good seasons, got injured, ended up in the CFL, and was like, you know, the CFL's Defensive Player of the Year for 2 seasons running with the Hamilton Tiger Cats. It was just that, like, it's like watching Deion Sanders play for high school kids. It was just like, you know, this guy's still got skills.
I think when Ken Crawley got – I would love to know why the Saints got rid of him, but when he got dumped by the Saints – it was sort of like he had so much experience and had played so well in the past. It was sort of like kind of a no-brainer for Miami because he was just drafted in 2016. So, I think there it was still a waiver claim process and stuff, and Miami has a high claim. So, yeah, they claimed him, and they just inserted him right away in this game. He was, I think, like 40 snaps, something like that. Ooh. And they just, you know, when they get a guy that's new, all of a sudden you have to simplify, right? Because you just pick the guy up off the street. So he's a wide corner. That's what he is. He's not doing anything else. They've got these other guys moving all over the place. It's really been since the bye week, and it's this defensive journey because they've been feeling everybody out and trying to figure out what they can do. And they got Eric since the bye week. They've had Eric Rowe as like a box safety, tight end, you know, eraser kind of player. Steven Parker no longer playing at free safety after the bye week, and then this week all of a sudden he shows back up on the field as a strong safety. Jamal Wiltz is playing like a very Devin McCourty-ish role, you know, a slot corner / free safety. Charles Harris has been reborn as a specialist part-time player. He's only on the field like 15 times a game, but it's mainly to pass rush, and so he doesn't have anything to think about. And Charles Harris, without anything to think about, is a better Charles Harris. So he's actually doing some things now. Sam Agüevan is still a sore spot,
they played yesterday though. Big play yesterday.
Yeah, but that's right. But
Jerome still, Baker reborn.
Jerome Baker reborn. Absolutely. No longer being played along the defensive edge, you know, as a sort of as a pseudo pass rusher Sam type type guy. Vince Beagle now is doing Beagle, that full time, you know, as just like a right outside linebacker, straight up, you know, pass rush guy. There's been a lot of changes that's been made all the way around the defense that I guess have rationalized it. And as a result, I mean, if you look at even something like the expected points, and it's a kind of an advanced metric that Pro Football Reference uses, and you see the difference pre-bye week and then post-bye week, what they've done on defense. I mean, this improvement of the team is defensive-led. I mean, the offense is still kind of up and down. But yeah, it's really impressive. It's a hell of a coaching job. And thanks, Simon. We were a two-point conversion away from having another win.
Dude, we were two-point conversion away from two games out of the playoffs.
two games out. We'd be two games out of the playoffs right now. Can you imagine? If Kenyon Drake had, you know, caught that ball and gotten in the end zone.
The funny thing is that Peter King wrote a piece today, or was part of his piece, about how the Browns were kind of on life support but had some kind of gumption moving forwards given the big win yesterday against the Bills, the Browns being 3-6. If we'd have beaten the Redskins, we'd be in the same 3-6 position, which would just be astounding.
And we wouldn't have all of that talent that they bought this offseason either.
If we win, I mean, look, we've talked
half, to them, literally.
And it's obvious that they need to get a bit more pressure. You know, Beagle's playing well, Baker, but out of, you know, John Jenkins is playing well, Wilkins is getting better week on week, but it, you know, it does feel like quarterbacks are having a little bit too much time in the pocket, and certainly more time than, you know, the Patriots give quarterbacks. So, you know, that does look like an area that needs improving upon. But you look at the rest of it and you think, Christ, we're doing this with street free agents, you know, undrafted,
especially in the secondary. How's that happening?
Isn't it? Without one of the best corners in the NFL, and frankly, one of the better safeties in the league, certainly, you know, the last few years, and Rashad Jones. And they're not being missed at all.
Nick Needham is the new Xavier Howard.
Nick Needham and Ryan Lewis were our starting corners yesterday.
Well, Ken Crawley, actually.
Okay.
Just off the street.
Yeah. I mean, just astonishing.
Unbelievable. Now, let me inject a little hope, which is weird, okay? I'm going to inject a little hope as far as a losing streak is concerned.
Oh. Well,
okay.
Is that the game we're playing again? Because I'm getting confused now. I'm like Barry Jackson. I don't know which way I need to go now.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me inject a little hope. All of this is defensive-led. At some point, it has to end, and you have to score points. This offense is not very good. It's, in my opinion, I think it's clear-cut the worst in the league. And I know that the Jets have their numbers and all of that, but the Jets at least have two offensive explosions. We have none. So where are we going to get these five wins? I think we're going to need to score points against the Giants for sure. Against the Jets in New York, they're going to have to score points. The Bills this week, are they going to be able to slug it out with the Bills? I'm afraid that they can, okay? So that there could be one win right there. So I don't know, man. I don't see how this offense is going to be good enough to get to five wins. So I think three or four wins is probably tops.
You're not buying the Mike Gesicki, explosion?
The loss of Preston Williams.
What about the Devontae Parker explosion?
They're beating the Bengals. That's three games already.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and I think that, really this team, the scariest part about this team is that week to week, they get a little bit better every time, even though the active roster gets a little bit worse each time.
Yes.
Like the active roster gets, it definitely does between trades and injuries. Like it gets worse every week.
But
and
how
yet
much
they're better.
How much of a job must these coaches be doing in the players' eyes, not just in our eyes? How much of a buy-in is there patently, obviously, from the players who are just looking at these guys and thinking, you know what, we can do this with street free agents and, you know, undrafted college kids. Imagine what's going to happen, you know, when we really get the wheels underneath us. Because a couple of weeks ago, Daniel Kilgore was joking about, I understand why teams, you know, fans want us to tank. And the players have bought in so dramatically. I mean, what is this week? Was this week 10? Week 9? Week 10?
Now in week 11.
The players have bought in so much into Flores and these coaches. That is a huge indictment in a positive way of surely what's to come. It does feel finally like we've got a really good head coach.
Brian Hoyer or no Brian Hoyer, and I think this win will be excused a lot because they were on their backup quarterback. The Vegas spread on the game right up to game time was still over 10, right? It was still 10.5. All right, that you usually don't get upsets on 10.5 point underdogs on the road.
And let's just boil it down to the actual games. Brian Hoyer came in after Brissett got hurt against Pittsburgh, and we already saw what the Steelers did to Jared Goff and that offense yesterday. Brian Hoyer came in and threw 2 touchdown passes and should have had a third that was called back for on a penalty.
But this is the team that
and really Vinatieri kind of cost them that game. So Brian Hoyer is a fine backup quarterback. He's not like all of that third string terrible quarterback stuff that was going on today. I don't buy none of that. Like
I mean, he's not the guy that was starting for the Lions yesterday, for example. I mean, he's like significantly.
Jesus
Christ. Yeah, I mean, but look, this is a team that's beaten the Titans, and the Titans beat the Chiefs yesterday. This is a team that's beaten the Chiefs. This is a team that has beaten the Texans. The Patrick Mahomes Chiefs, the Deshaun Watson Texans. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a team that, you know, these are no mugs. And when I checked yesterday, Marlon Mack was still playing and Ebron was still playing and Quentin Nelson was still playing. Costanzo was still playing. Darius Leonard was playing. Malik Hooker was playing. You know, the only guy that wasn't playing was Jacoby Brissett, pretty much, you know, and T.Y. Hilton. Beyond that, you know, you can't, and at some point, the rubber meets the road when it comes to excuse making.
And I think you can kind of like handle it if it was just like, if it just came out of nowhere, right? If it came out of nowhere, it's like, okay, you know, any given Sunday in the NFL, that's fluky, whatever. But it didn't come out of nowhere. It had been building for a while. You know, they'd been, obviously the Dolphins were just flat awful against the Ravens, not much better against the Patriots. They were a little bit better against the Cowboys, but still not good at all. You know, a little bit better against the Chargers. The next game against the Redskins, they basically almost won, you know, purely in the fourth quarter because Ryan Fitzpatrick came in the fourth quarter and galvanized them. And then they played tough against the Bills, but, you know, some fluky plays went the onside kick touchdown and, you know, some stuff like that. The Ryan Fitzpatrick threw a pick right in the end zone. I mean, the Steelers seemed like it could have been a close game. They stomped the Jets, and then all of a sudden they go into a 5-3 team's house and beat them in their house. I mean, that's it all builds on each other. And if this is like the Patriots, how they just keep getting better and better. I mean, the Patriots always play their best. I keep saying this. They play their best football in December. And coincidentally, in December, we're facing like the Jets and the Giants and the Bengals and the Patriots in week 17. They might be on their backups in that game. I mean, because they might not have anything to play for at that
point. Yeah, but that game is still in New England, I think.
Yeah, but if it's not against Tom Brady, then and we are playing our best football in December, then couldn't we actually go 4-0 to end the season? It's not out of the realm of possibility. It's really not. I mean, which is amazing to think about. It's absolutely amazing.
We'll have 3 picks in the 20s in the first round.
We'll have, yeah, that's, that'll be the 20s. That'll be the saddest thing.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, credit most of all, I think, to Josh Boyer, the defensive pass game coordinator, because the job that he's done with that unit. And interesting, I was reading earlier on that Boyer was the guy that found Malcolm Butler at West Alabama. And Boyer and Flores went to see Butler play when Butler ran a 4.68, and they went and sat and watched tape with him. And apparently Flores was like, dude does not look like he runs a 4.68 at all. He looks like he runs a 4.3 when he actually plays. So, you know, the job that those guys have done on the back end is just incredible.
Well, after the draft, I remember this specifically because it was kind of a talking point. After the draft, they really specifically went for undrafted free agent corners. And Josh Boyer took a major hand in that. I remember like when the scouts were talking about, they did their video series and they're going to talk about all the UDFAs and stuff like that. They talked about how active Josh Boyer was in that effort. And Boyer gave a lot of, you know, quotes talking about how he found Malcolm Butler from nowhere and stuff like that.
So this was the intent. Jonathan Jones.
Yes, exactly. So this was the intent. The intent all along was to get Josh Boyer to uncover these sort of diamonds in the rough. And kudos to them to sticking with it because it looked ugly as fuck at first. I mean, some of those UDFAs that they got are now no longer here. The Boise State guy, you know, there's some of Montre Hardage is not here and stuff like that. But Nick Needham looked ugly as hell, right? In preseason and the regular season, we're panning him constantly.
In practice,
and now he's the next Xavier Howard all of a sudden. And
I want to go.
No player really epitomizes the Dolphins like Nick Needham himself.
Maybe because the next Darryl Green.
That's the Dolphins this year. That's the Dolphins this year. Ugly as hell to start with, and then all of a sudden, whoa, where'd that come from?
Exactly. Needham, Tyler Horton, and Hartage all cited Boyer's history with undrafted free agents as the reason they signed with the Dolphins in the first place, which is again a pretty incredible statement, really. And I think Hartage is on the practice squad, isn't he?
And it's continued because there's like Ken Webster, Ryan Lewis, these guys that they're start claiming, and now Ken Crawley I think is a little bit of a different category because he's got a lot of skins on the wall and he just found himself available and we claimed him, which was the smart move.
The secondary feels like a New England secondary.
It doesn't.
It feels like you just drop a guy in there.
The whole defense does.
Yeah, doesn't it? And you just think when you get a couple of pass rushers, a couple of those edge guys, you know, whether that's in the draft, whether that's, you know, some of those guys that we talked to. I mean, I don't know if you saw, I was watching Red Zone yesterday and the statistics on Matthew Judon, who's a guy that we've talked about a lot. I mean, JJ and TJ Watt have 20, what was it, 20? I can't remember what the figure was, 20 QB pressures this season. To lead the league, but tied for second is Judon with 17. And you think there's a guy who, you know, you watch the Ravens defensively and he's everywhere. Do you know what I mean? He fits the kind of mold of the sort of player. We talked about last week about Yannick Ngakoue and Kyler Fackrell's a guy that you and I have talked about offline. And, you know, they're the sort of players that you just plug a couple of these guys in along with the Beagle. Where does Van Ginkel fit? You know, Wilkins is coming on, Jenkins is coming on, Needham's there, all these kids. McMillan's playing well. Baker all of a sudden looks like the guy that we thought he was going to be. Doesn't feel like too much tinkering is needed on that defensive side if they can get these guys playing at this level week in,
but there's also a caution, right? There's also a caution because, like, this thing is working with these low-level guys, these desperate guys that are doing everything exactly they want the way they want. And I think that sometimes you just assume that you can go and get, you know, kind of a higher-priced guy, and he comes right in and fits right in. And what we've seen time and time again with New England is that's not necessarily always the case, right? I mean, they get a guy that on paper looks good, and you know, 5 weeks in they decide he doesn't fit and they cut him or something like that. That's the way things happen in New England. So it could be a little more difficult to add like sort of the star power that we want to add to the defense than we might think because of the way they do things. But at the same time, they grow it too, you know? So they, you know, they're going to keep drafting guys. Christian Wilkins is going to be whatever he is in a couple of years. And who knows, maybe Andrew Van Ginkel, because Sam Agüevan right now is a pass rusher for this, you know, as an outside linebacker pass rusher for this defense primarily. And that ain't working. So, you know, what happens when Andrew Van Ginkel gets back in?
Agüevan feels like one of those guys that could just fall off the team in the not too distant future.
Unless
he's really good on special teams because they need help
True.
Ryan
Lewis, I think Miami's his sixth or seventh team that he's had. He only came out in 2017. So it's not like he's, you know, he's bounced around. All of a sudden he just looks like, you know, he looks a player.
Yeah.
Just another one of these guys. It's
Yeah, and Lamons, Chris Lamons, I think, is going to be here for a while because he's
special
a
really teams guy.
Yeah, special teams, yeah.
And if he's your eighth defensive back or your seventh defensive back, I don't think, you know, I think he's very capable of filling that role. You know, he's not completely incompetent. So yeah. I like him too as a player going forward. But everybody, you know, yesterday, if you were on Twitter and, you know, God, don't do that, people. Like after the Dolphins, whatever result you don't want, don't go on Twitter after that because
you at all
faith in humanity. All right. I made the mistake yesterday of going on Twitter and seeing what the plebs were saying, and it wasn't pretty, okay?
Sorry, listeners. We didn't mean you're the plebs.
Okay. Is plebs like plebs?
plebs. In United States American, yes.
Yes.
Okay.
And it wasn't pretty. One guy proclaimed that win as setting us back 15 years. You know, which is odd, you know,
because
usually everybody says that it sets you back a decade. This guy went to 15 years.
Very specific.
Yeah, he was very, very specific. I was wondering, I wanted to respond to him, you know, like, are you sure it's not 16? But I'll ask you straight out. We all want, you know, we wanted, okay? And Tua Tagovailoa, he played great on Saturday, and we're going to get to that game. We're going to review that game in a little bit here. Do you think it's over? Do you think it's over, Simon? Is there no shot now?
No, I don't think you. We've got we've got 9 picks in the first 2 rounds of the next 2 drafts. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's more than enough. If he's really the guy that they love, if he's really the guy, if Rich Eisen is right, and what Rich Eisen heard 2 years ago, that the Dolphins were all in on Tua, if what the whispers that we've heard from the people that we know are right about where Tua stands above everybody else in the Dolphins' current pecking order, if that's the guy that they truly want, then they have the capital to go up and get it. Let's just say we end up with the 4th pick, for example. The Bengals take Joe Burrow because he will probably win the Heisman. He'll probably end up having a better year, and he probably suits Zach Taylor's system a little bit better. Let's just say he goes first overall. Let's say the Jets have the 2nd pick, and the Jets take Chase Young, and why wouldn't they? Washington have the 3rd pick, and there's the left tackle from Georgia goes to them. Why wouldn't they? Because Trent Williams isn't going to play for them ever again. All of a sudden, the Dolphins are sitting there at 4, taking Tua Tagovailoa. But let's just say that, you know, the Jets don't want to move out of 2 because they don't want to lose Chase Young. But a team is calling the Redskins saying, we want to move up and, you know, this is what we can offer you. The Dolphins can match and beat any offer because they've got the picks, they've got the capital. So whilst I think the percentage chance of us securing him has gone down, I still don't feel there's a reason that we would lose him if we really want him.
I think in my gut, in my bones, I feel like we have lost him. Because I think that even though everything we hear is that, yes, not everybody in the league has him as the number one quarterback right now.
Nope.
I get that. But I still think that by the end of the season and as we get through the process, it's going to start, it's going to start shaping that way. It's going to be start heading that way. And if you're the Cincinnati Bengals, and I mean, this all hinges on whether the Bengals take him or not. And we like to think, you know, hey, this, maybe they like Joe Burrow more, or maybe they like Justin Herbert more, but you know, are we sure about that? Do we even have solid footing to say that they would like one of those guys more? I think that Tua actually changed the narrative about him in this game. And we're going to talk about the game, but all we heard about all year and for more than a year about Tua is Clemson and Georgia, Clemson and Georgia, you know, over and over again, big games, big defenses, you know, he shits the bed. This was a big defense. This was a big game and he didn't shit the bed. He actually did really well. He was on one leg and, you know, he kind of willed his team into it. They also say everything is just too easy for him, right? The offense is too machine-like. It's wide open receivers and, you know, all he does is throw a slant and then the guy runs 60 yards and stuff. Well, this was not easy, right? He was being hit constantly. He had pressure in his face constantly. The receivers were being derouted. I mean, the receivers were not open or the windows were tight. and he was hitting guys. Anyway, he threw four touchdowns.
And his all-world wide receiver and wide receiver number one in this draft did not have a good game.
Yeah, he dropped the ball. He dropped the ball twice.
I mean, something that plays into this, something that plays into this as well that I think is well worth thinking about is that there's a likelihood that Tua only plays four more games at Alabama. A strong likelihood, actually. You know, Mississippi State, Western Carolina, Auburn, and then whoever they play in the bowl game. Because there's a pretty strong chance that they don't make the playoff. A pretty strong chance. The Penn State loss at the weekend obviously didn't help, but, you know, if Oregon go unbeaten, they're almost certainly going to get in, unless you aren't going to lose now. Ohio State aren't going to lose.
What are you going to do with Minnesota too?
I mean, ultimately, Minnesota are going to play out against Ohio State in the Big Ten Championship, aren't they? So we'll see how that plays out. But, you know, they're at Baylor. I mean, there are teams there that are going to that will come into consideration ahead of Alabama. So there's a chance that Tua only plays four more games, whereas Joe Burrow's got his three regular season games, plus the SEC Championship, plus the bowl semifinal, plus a potential national championship game. There's six more opportunities for people to see Joe Burrow. There may only be four more. Look, we don't even know how. We saw how he limped off the field on Saturday. At what point do you think to yourself, you know what, we're going to beat Mississippi State and we'll beat Western Carolina, so why don't we get him healthy for Auburn and then, you know, and see where the chips lay? I mean, you know, I just think there's an opportunity for teams to see more of Joe Burrow and get more excited about Burrow than there will be about Tua, but given the fact that there's only potentially four more games of his Alabama career left.
Yeah, but isn't there a flip side to that? Like, if Joe Burrow has, you know, however many games left, listen, let's face it, he came from sort of day three-ish, right? When we can agree that before the season started, Joe Burrow, where is he going to go?
You know,
max round three.
Yeah.
Right. I saw that Dane Brugler said that you know, people that he talked to, it wasn't necessarily unanimous agreement. It was day three-ish. Some people had him more like round three. But anyway, that's where he came from. So he's got to make this big journey upward, right? And in order to do that, you've got to be perfect, and he has been. He has been perfect in order to do that. But now he's got all these games. If he slips and stumbles even one of them, then it's probably over for him with number one pick, right?
Do you think?
I think it could be. He needs to be perfect. I mean,
Peter King in his column today was speaking to a couple of GMs, said, I mean, what more do you need to see now? I mean, he's been and beaten Auburn. He's beaten Florida, you know, one of the best defensive secondaries in the country. He's beaten Texas on the road. He's beaten Alabama on the road. I mean, who else has got that? You know, Justin Herbert, where's that resume? Do you know what I mean? When's the next big game Justin Herbert wins is the first big game Justin Herbert wins. You know, I kind of feel like, and also, where are these defeats coming? I mean, they've got unranked Mississippi, unranked Arkansas, and unranked Texas A&M.
You know, well, if they face Georgia in the SEC championship,
yeah, of course. Right. I mean,
if they lose to Georgia in that game,
yeah. But LSU look, I mean, they look the cream of the crop. This season. I mean,
yeah.
I don't think Georgia beat them. I'd be surprised if Georgia beat them, I've got to say. And then a national championship game against potentially Ohio State, which then, you know, all bets are off, aren't they? I mean, win or lose. If he's got that far, he's done all those things, he's won the Heisman, you know, and he has one down game, you still look back and say, you know what, he won the SEC title and he beat Texas on the road, Alabama on the road, Florida, Auburn. You know, Auburn got one of the best defenses in the country. It's I don't know. It's such a fascinating, so fascinating. With so far to go, still we still got months to go.
Well, let me make a case why I think it's still very realistic that Tua Tagovailoa is going to end up here, and that's the hype train for Joe Burrow is not. It's on the tracks and it's headed right to the Heisman, which will lead him to more visibility on all the national networks. So the hype is going to be there. His team is better than Tua Tagovailoa's. So he might also have a national championship. okay? And I understand it's just one game. The game was in Alabama, okay? And for, you know, okay, I understand that Tua Tagovailoa brought us, well, brought us. Now I'm talking as if we're all Alabama Crimson Tide fans. But he did bring them back, but they were down 3 touchdowns. Joe Burrow did that. And I'm sorry. He's performed so well. He's going to get the trophies, multiple trophies, the individual awards. And then in the offseason, when you get to the combine, he's so mechanically sound that no matter what you may think about his throwing power, his mechanics are going to be good enough where he's going to be adequate enough in drills where nobody's going to really say that he has, I would say, problems with his arm strength. Similar to what Lamar Jackson did. And we all know that Lamar Jackson timed terribly throwing the football. He was timed under 50 miles an hour. And he was the only quarterback that was invited to the combine that tested under 50 miles an hour.
Not a single team actually even pays attention to those radar readings. Not a single team. They don't care about them whatsoever.
But if that's the main knock, and then you go out there and you're actually the worst guy throwing, I think people are going to pay attention. If that's the main knock on Joe Burrow. Because I'm sorry, there's no other knock. Like, if we're going to talk production, you know, the horse left the barn this year.
I think there's no other knock. I mean, the fact of the matter is he played a lot of good teams in 2018 and he didn't do well. I mean, he threw one touchdown and like 4 interceptions or something like that against the good teams.
Here's the production for Burrow since he's been at LSU. So 22 games, okay? 49 touchdowns passing, 9 interceptions, 10 touchdowns rushing. He's got a 70% completion percentage and 8 wins against top 10 opponents in 22 games, which is more than any other quarterback in college football across the board. 8 wins against top 10 opponents. That's a pretty interesting number.
It's interesting, but it's also, you have to understand, it's like all this year, or mostly all this year. I mean, he had some moments later in 2018 against, you know, kind of some worse opponents, but last year, I mean, it really is. You look at 2018. This is the reason he was a day 3 pick heading into this year. Like, there's a lot of good traits there. There's a lot of stuff. There's some flashes and stuff like that. But when it gets right down to it, he played good teams and he just looked like he was in over his head from a talent standpoint. And then you fast forward to this year, and now Joe Brady comes over from New Orleans, and there's a lot of credit being given to Joe Brady here. There's a lot of respect there. He's in a new offense with Joe Brady, and he is blossomed. And you're going to have to keep that going, right? Because, you know, why mess with a good thing? So you're going to have to tailor the offense to make it, you know, look like that. And I think that, yeah, there's going to be some skepticism, not just because of the arm power. The arm power is a thing. It is, it is in sort of problematic areas, but also because of the one-year wonder thing. And teams don't like one-year wonders. I mean, they like guys that have been consistent for a while. I mean, this is not new. This is not coming out of the blue, okay? Teams don't like guys that couldn't do it in 2018, but then all of a sudden, whoa, in 2019, as a 23-year-old, it, you know, just exploded.
And another thing that I think helps us, meaning the Miami Dolphins, as far as landing Tua Tagovailoa, is this. Tua Tagovailoa has hardware in both ankles and was last seen limping on the sideline after he had taken several hits and didn't look all that great after the game. Limping around, holding his quad, looking kind of ginger on the sideline. So I think that also helps. That plays right into the Dolphins' hands because any of those knocks are knocks that Joe Burrow doesn't have. Mm-hmm. So I could see the scenario where if Joe Burrow goes number one, then all we got to do is be somewhere around the top 4, like Simon said, in that scenario. Now, of course, if we make the playoffs, then okay, forget it.
We're not making the playoffs.
No, I understand. I have us winning 3 games, okay?
Are we actually pondering that?
I have us winning 3 games because I just don't think that this defense can keep it up for the rest of the year. So I have us picking somewhere around 2nd or 3rd.
Okay.
All right? Yeah, I think we win one more.
I dig it.
Okay, I think we win that Cincinnati game, okay? Now, all of that is in our favor. If we're picking 2nd, I think we got them. And if we don't have them and we are picking 2nd, is Cincinnati really going to be that married to taking Tua Tagovailoa number 1? that they won't, you know, they won't entertain a trade to just move down one spot and take the Heisman Trophy winner, Joe Burrow? You know, I don't know, man. I think a lot is in our favor. Unless, of course, we go on some type of ridiculous win streak, like in 2011. When they started,
I still think
and
they
ended
have
up winning six.
They have so much capital, but also I don't think if the Bengals love Tua, they're not going to move down and let somebody else take the guy they want. They just and feel like Joe Burrow is a nice secondary prison. They're just not going to do that.
And I feel like you're rolling at least a 50-50 die whether that's the case.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so because I think that that's how it's probably going to break down as far as NFL GMs. Like maybe 50%. Might be on the Tua bandwagon and maybe 40% might be on somebody else's bandwagon. And then you're going to have the stragglers, like four or five GMs that think Chase Young is the best player in the draft.
I think the Bengals will take either Burrow or Herbert. I don't think they'll take Tua. That's just my personal opinion.
Let us pray.
Let's pray.
Let's hope Mike Tannenbaum becomes the general manager of Bengals. Obviously, if for people that didn't see it, he was on Mike Golic's show this morning and was asked who would choose between Joe Burrow and Tua, and he just went, "I'd take Justin Herbert," and then proceeded to downplay Burrow's size, even though he's 6'4", 220, and said that he was not a big man, and then said that Tua was injury prone, even though Justin Herbert has had a broken leg, a broken collarbone, a concussion, and a number of issues this season.
He's got a long list.
Knee injuries forced him to leave games, but yeah, I mean, well, okay,
Mike, that was ridiculous. That wasn't it. That was absurd. But yeah, let's hope. Let's hope the Bengals are paying attention to him or hire him or something. And the Bengals are notorious for running a very small scouting department.
Yeah, smallest in the league.
Yeah, but I think some of the past history is sort of in the past as far as some of their stupidest mistakes personnel wise go, and I think that they're a little bit brought up into the wider world now. So I don't know. It's like I said, it's at least just a coin flip whether Tua is their guy or not, and I think that if he is their guy, they're not going to trade the pick.
No,
you know,
there's always the possibility that Tua Tagovailoa will do what Eli Manning did to the Chargers, to a team like the Cincinnati Bengals.
Also a possibility. Yeah.
What do you think would happen in our respective households should Miami, let's say, end up with a third pick and the Bengals take Burrow first overall and we get really excited. The Jets stay where they are and take Chase Young, leaving the Dolphins open. And Roger Goodell steps to the podium and says, and with a third overall pick, the Miami Dolphins select quarterback Justin Herbert. What would happen?
Well, how many TVs would be broken? Really, really, really drunk because I'm gonna be on the strip in Las Vegas.
I'm gonna take a page from Chris Joseph and send Chris Greer a box of cat shit.
And then you hear with the fourth overall pick there's been a trade. New England Patriots are at the four spot.
Well, now you're just twisting the knife. Now you're,
I know.
Okay.
I know.
Yeah, that's just a horror movie. You're just right.
Can I just say I do put, in all seriousness, all jokes aside, a serious amount of significance in the fact that Stephen Ross was at the LSU Alabama game at the weekend. That to me is a serious amount of significance for that.
I think that's fair.
Maybe Stephen Ross has already written on a post-it note to Tua Tagovailoa, no matter what.
I mean, he probably hasn't written that, but I suspect that he has made it fairly clear the guy that he likes. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at the wow plays that Lamar Jackson had at Louisville. You look at the wow plays that Tua has at Alabama. You know, certainly with his arm. I don't think Steve Ross will look at anything else. You know, Joe Burrow is a good player, and Steve Ross, I'm sure, will look at him and go, "What a good player!" But there's a longevity to Tua. It's 2.5 years now, 2.5 seasons. Ross is no mug. Just to me, that strikes me as Tua, the Hawaii kid, Miami, the wearing number 13, the Russell Wilson-esque, all those little things just add up to something a little bit Miami-ish.
Mm-hmm.
I will tell you this, the last two games, they have shown the owner's box at some point in the game, like video. And I swear, I mean, these were two wins, all right? We were beating the team when they would show the owner's box. These guys all looked like their favorite auntie just died. I mean, every single one of them, Steve Ross, Garfinkel, they're like leaning back. They're looking totally glum. Dan Marino yesterday, is just like,
did you see yesterday? Yesterday it was that was the best visual ever. And it was pointed out to me by my friend, because I was at his house to watch the Cowboys and the Vikings. And we were watching the end of this game, and Hoyer throws that last interception. Remember the last interception that he threw, which, you know, was ominous, because I was like, okay, this is the drive where they could put something together. And then right away we pick him off. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, my God, here we go. We're going to go put in the touchdown that ices the game. And they pan to Dan Marino in the owner's box. And Dan Marino looks like somebody had just killed his dog.
Yeah.
He looked absolutely distraught. So who knows? Maybe it's the feeling going around the organization is that we want this guy, you know, and these wins aren't helping too much.
But, I mean, to be fair, okay, so what happens if we can't get the guy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, this is a question I get all the time. I don't know about you guys. I'm sure we get it on the 3YPC account. You know, what's your feeling? Like, what do you I mean, is it Joe Burrow? Is it Jake Fromm? Is it Justin Herbert?
Yeah, look, I don't have rock solid information on this, but if I had to make a bet, and I'm known to make a bet, and you could check on our 3YPC account, you know, 16-7 this year, okay, every Thursday. So go check that out every Thursday on our 3YPC account. If I had to bet, I would say that the backup plan is either Herbert or Jordan Love. They've just devoted so many resources to those two guys. And Joe Burrow just getting on the scene now, unless, you know, they're working on something that I don't know about and nobody else really knows about. I would say that the conversation for QB2 is centered on those two guys.
See, the thing is, I think it would probably be Herbert, but I think they also would think, and I'm sure they've already played these scenarios out or will play these scenarios out, I think they think that they could potentially get Jordan Love in the mid-teens and therefore do something different at 4-3, wherever it is that they pick, 6, I don't know where, you know, that to me, you know, I could, you could see a scenario where they came away with, I don't know, Young, Love, Humphrey with their 3 picks rather than, you know, do you know what I mean? I think that they will work out a situation in which, you know, and look, Ryan Fitzpatrick's playing really good football. We joked in the preseason that he wasn't going to last more than 3 games or whatever. And he's shown durability. The guys clearly love playing for him. If you bring Jordan Love in, you're not going to want to start Jordan Love week one next season. What you're going to want to have him do is exactly what happened with Patrick Mahomes and Alex Smith, is get him in behind a really great veteran, a guy that's been around the league, who understands football, who understands teaching, you know, who's just a player's guy. And you just say to Jordan Love, you know, just like Pat Mahomes did with Alex Smith, move in with the Fitzpatricks, essentially. You know, you just learn everything about the game, the nuance of the offense, about playing the position, practice, 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 watch, all those sorts of things. Fitzpatrick is pretty much the perfect guy to be the bridge for a guy like Jordan Love. Whilst then your first pick, whether it's Andrew Thomas, whether it's Grant Delpit, whether it's Okuda, whether it's Chase Young, whoever, is, you know, doing their thing and starting, you know, and you're not necessarily inured to a quarterback having to come in and start straight away, because we've got the bridge guy there, plus, you know, the other first round picks are doing their thing.
What I wonder, and this is, you know, Jordan Love has been we've talked about him for a long time, and I love him dearly. The more that I'm starting to trust this coaching staff, I guess, the more that I'm starting to lean actually toward Jake Fromm of Georgia. And that's because he's so clearly compatible with this style, this coaching staff, everything they do, everything they value. I mean, they talk about leadership. They talk about being able to command the offense, every aspect of the offense, the protection calls and the nuance and stuff, and being able to call out the defenses and stuff like that. That's all Jake Fromm's specialty. He is a master at that stuff at Georgia, and he's been doing it for 3 years. He's been doing it from a very young age. He's a leader, and he's very capable on the football field. I think his arm strength is highly underrated. I think that there's upside with his arm strength because he isn't following through with his feet as well as he could. I mean, I've talked about it on the Twitter account several times, and if you look at him, he's kind of just snapping the ball off with his arm a lot of times and not really using his – a bit like Andrew Luck used to do when he was at Stanford. And so I think that there's actually upside for what he can do from a power standpoint. He's already throwing at pro velocity. He's already achieving that regularly. But I think that – I don't know. I think that there's so much there that's just so fully compatible with everything that they do on offense and everything that they value, that I can't see how they wouldn't want him. I can't see how they wouldn't like him a whole lot. And they're quiet about him. I get that. And we talked about some of that earlier. But yeah, I mean, the more I trust this coaching staff, the more I'm like, well, you know, maybe I trust them enough to get the guy that's compatible with the system instead of the guy like Jordan Love, who's just – you know, arm talent extraordinaire. I mean, he's just a savant that way.
Now, let me ask
you. But also erratic.
All right, now let me ask you this, Simon and Chris. I'd like to get your input on this. Marvin Allen was the regional scout for the Atlanta Falcons down there. If you know regional scouts, they usually live at the facility of whatever college team is very near to their pro team. So Marvin Allen basically owned the campus at UGA. He's yet to make a trip out there. Do you put any stock in that? This is the guy that's going to be doing the draft board in essence. So he has Chris Greer's job from last year. Do you put any stock in that or no, Simon?
I mean, look, we've talked about, you know, I've sat in enough press boxes to know that most of the time these scouts are fucked off by halftime. You know, Chris and I sat behind Chris Greer at Tampa Stadium watching Florida State a couple of years ago when Dalvin Cook was playing. Dalvin ripped off, had a big game. And Chris and I were literally sat behind him, and he'd gone, hadn't he, Chris, by the start of the third quarter. He wasn't there. I mean, it depends what you get from seeing people in public as opposed to watching them on tape, I suppose. You know, you want to kind of get down on the sideline and that kind of thing. But oftentimes you sit with scouts and GM, certainly with GMs, not so much scouts, but GMs are often talking to one another and they're doing bits and they're writing notes and they're also, they're not really, scouts are much more there with binoculars and things. And you quite often get scouts. I was at the Clemson Texas A&M game earlier in the season. There was a couple of Falcon scouts there. And I was talking to one of the guys, and he said, I said, oh, who are you scouting? We went through certainly, he talked to me about some of the players I was looking at and whatever. And I said, what do you think? I said to him, what do you think of Isaiah Simmons in terms of his position versatility and how that manifests itself at the NFL level? He said, to be honest, I'm not watching him. I'm only on seniors duty. He said, I'm not watching any underclassmen at all. I'm just here to watch seniors. Mm-hmm. He said, the guy I'm with is watching juniors, but I'm fully focused just on seniors, which I thought was really interesting. I hadn't realized that was even a thing. But I don't know. I just wonder what you get from, there's so many distractions at a game. There's so much noise, especially in some of those, you know, Clemson, Mississippi State, Alabama, where the windows are open to the press box where the scouts sit, and it's so loud, the noise comes in, and there's so many things going on. And I just wonder how much you really gain from being in the press box when you only see half a game, as opposed to sitting there with a clicker going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. I don't know, Chris, what do you think? I mean, for me, I personally would rather watch on film, but that's just a personal thing.
And I think that's sort of the point with, and I think what Alf is sort of alluding to is, you know, if you're Marvin Allen, then you've got the connections. You want to know the deal, somebody else's opinion.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you want to know the deal of Jake Fromm, then you can put in a call. He's got the connections there, and maybe he can, or maybe that was a long time ago. Who knows? But I will say that you do want the fresh eyes. And if you're the guy putting together the draft board, I think you have your scouts giving you your reports, and you'll do a lot of film work. I mean, you're not going to, I don't think you necessarily need to be out there mm-hmm. at every game live. And like Simon said, it's chaotic out there during the games. There's only so much you can pay attention to. And sometimes these guys are just shooting the shit anyway. So I think that, I think it doesn't necessarily mean anything. If anything, you know, I'm kind of like wondering why things are so quiet on Jake Fromm personally, because he fits so well with everything that they do and their style of offense and their style, just their style as a team, not even as an offense. So I wonder about that, but I wouldn't read much into it. I think because, listen, it's only beginning in November too. There's lots of time for Marvin Allen to put in a phone call, and we don't know that he hasn't put in a phone call anyway. Already. So I don't know. I'm not inclined to read into it, but I am curious that nobody's connecting the dots between Miami and Jake Fromm.
Well, we promised the people we will have something on this game that was played on Saturday. So very briefly, Simon, what were your impressions of this game on Saturday? I thought it was one of the best college football games I'd seen in years.
Yeah, it was tremendous. I mean, it was an NFL game played at the college football level. You look at the talent that was on show, you know, on both sides of the ball. You look at a quarterback in Tua Tagovailoa dominating in the second half, certainly, you know, when he'd got his sea legs under him and, you know, the rust had kind of worn off, dominating a secondary that contained three top 15 draft picks in Grant Delpit, in Derek Stingley, who was the number one corner in the nation, even though he was a true freshman, was playing at such an elite level, and yet he toasted him. And Christian Fulton, who, you know, coming off the foot injury, but has really started to find himself. You know, you look at Calavion Chason against Alex Leatherwood. I thought Leatherwood played really well. You've got, you know, this first round versus sort of top 40, you know, two top 40 guys. You look at Xavier McKinney, played really well, showed that great open field tackling. You know, you look at the receiver. I think Devontae Smith has made more money for himself than maybe any Alabama player this season.
Absolutely.
You know, it was interesting what Jerry Jeudy said, that Jeudy said, I'm the best route runner. Jalen Waddle is the quickest twitch. Ruggs is the fastest, and Devonta just catches everything. And that's going to count for an awful lot at the next level. You know, the guy that, who do you want? Do you want the guy that can, you know, do you want John Ross or do you want Larry Fitzgerald in terms of, I'm not saying that Devonta Smith is Larry Fitzgerald, but, you know, do you want, and I'm not saying that Ruggs is John Ross, but you kind of get the point. Do you want the guy who can run out of the stadium, or do you want the guy who, you know, you can throw to on every single, you know, he's going to come down with it. He's going to be, you know, the reliable receiver that you're looking for. And I think most of the time you'd say, actually, I want the reliable guy. I think he made himself an awful lot of money. You look at the running backs. I talked about it on 3 yards per carry account the other day. I've been a fan of Clyde Edwards-Helaire for a while. I think he's a really good player. He's got a kind of a mix of sort of Mark Ingram with a little bit of, they talked about Darren Sproles, but I kind of feel like he's got a bit of Emmitt Smith in his game. Mm. He's small, he's undersized, but he just looks like Emmitt Smith. He's got just the lower leg strength is phenomenal. I think he's a factor back at the next level. He's a three down player. He's got great hands. He can pass protect. And Najee Harris, who just has, you know, has finally started to come into his own. You know, the number one rated player in America in high school 2 seasons ago, and has sort of waited his turn. I think that they've expected him to kick on a little bit, and it's been a slower process for him.
He has a little bit
of Derrick Henry, because I don't think he's massively fast. He's not, you know, but he's patient, and he's got good vision, and it kind of feels like he gets it now, you know. And I think the catch, the back shoulder throw and catch was terrific, and he was just able to, you know, Tua played really well in the second half, but he was the perfect complement, and he kind of took over a critical point in that game. So I just thought it was a terrific game, a great chess match. And look, hats off to Ed Orgeron as well. I think he's just done a tremendous job. I mean, people were like, you know, is he the guy? Is he, you know, LSU struggled. I mean, I went to Alabama LSU 2 seasons ago in Tuscaloosa. LSU were unranked, and their starting quarterback was the kid that the Patriots drafted in the 7th round a couple of years back, and you just like, this team is a long way away. And now look at them, you know, they went into Tuscaloosa, 105,000 people, the whole of the country watching, the president there, and they blew Alabama. I remember, what was it, 33-14? They just blew them away. I thought it was a great game. I thought it was an absolutely super game.
They were winning 33-13, I think.
33-13, yeah. And actually, it was a really good day of college football because I watched Minnesota-Penn State before that. That was a really good game as well. You know, some really good players on that. The receivers for Minnesota were terrific. Antoine Winfield, terrific. But yeah, that was just an all-timer, a really good game that lived up to the billing.
I was very happy that, considering how hyped it was, that it turned out the way it did, yeah. Which was, like you said, an all-timer. It was a really, really entertaining football game. And yeah, we were paying attention to the quarterbacks, but it was interesting that Najee Harris and Edwards-Helaire they threatened to pull the spotlight away from the quarterbacks.
Absolutely.
At times. They looked like each quarterback's right-hand man, you know, doing the damage for them.
Although Joe Burrow made sure to steal Hilaire's shine after the game when he was trying to get interviewed. I don't know if you guys saw that.
No, I didn't.
Bothered
I didn't
me see a little that. Bit. Just a little bit.
Well, Joe Burrow's an interesting guy. See his Twitter history. But yeah, so I thought it was very very cool to see like how each guy, you know, had sort of his partner in crime, I guess, and doing a bunch of damage and really just beating up that Alabama's defense has been on the ropes for a little bit. I mean, it's been covered up, it's been hidden, but I mean this is not a strong defense. Hasn't been a strong defense since they took some injuries, I think, you know, partway through last year actually. And so I think that it really broke open, and Tua, even though he got on track and started bringing his team back, what he needed was he needed a stop, right? He needed a stop from that defense, and they couldn't get one. And it reminded me a lot of the Kyler Murray versus Tua Tagovailoa matchup in the playoffs last year. Like Kyler Murray was a little bit slow to start with. And then he really started to get, you know, after probably only two drives, I think he really started to heat up and started scoring a bunch of points. And Nick Saban was trying to stop him, and he kept scoring. But really what needed to happen is Oklahoma just needed to be able to stop Tua once, right?
And they couldn't.
And they couldn't at all. Like, Tua just cut right through them through the entire game. And that's what happened with Joe Burrow and the LSU offense here, with those receivers and the offensive line doing pretty well, and then that running back, you know, Edwards-Helaire. I mean, it was really fantastic. It was fun to see. Both quarterbacks, in the end, I did think that they moved the needle because I thought that Tua did it by challenging a narrative about him, about things always being easy for him and him blowing it in big games. Neither of those things happened. And then with Joe Burrow, I think he moved the needle because in the end, this is a really big game.
Yeah, so, I felt the Tua Tagovailoa was intentionally not throwing slants. Challenge the narrative.
Well, they weren't open. I mean,
they were just taking him away, though, weren't they? They were just paying inside coverage.
At one point he reached, I think it was 16 attempts without throwing a slant, and then he threw one, and then of course Judy dropped it.
Yeah, that's true. That's true also. Yeah. But, I mean, Burrow's got to – like I said, there are two main criticisms about Burrow to me and that I think are out there, which is one is the arm power we know about, but two is the fact that, hey, 2018 wasn't so good, and then all of a sudden 2019 is an explosion. Where did that come from? He can't do anything about that. But then he can't do anything about that, right?
Yeah.
2018, he can't rewrite history.
He could, right? But he beat four top 10 teams last year. You think about it, Miami, who were number 8 in the first game of the season. Then he beat Auburn, who were number 6. Then he beat Georgia, who were number 2. And then the bowl game, he beat UCF for the first time in however many, 29, 25 games or whatever, who were number 6 at that point. So,
I mean, he did it, but he did it in sort of a Josh Allen way without completing a lot of passes and throwing interceptions.
Very good against Auburn. He was very good.
You know what Joe Burrow reminded me of? And I'm not comparing him to this guy, okay, people? So don't get after me on Twitter. I'm not saying that they're the same guy. But it reminded me what Joe Burrow did on Saturday. It reminded me of one of those Tim Tebow tidal waves that used to happen when you played the Gators, where it was just – he was just a force of nature.
He's so accurate, though. I mean, Tebow was never accurate.
No, but I'm talking about as a college player. A guy
Debo completed like 70%+ in college. Yeah. It was odd. I mean,
Tebow's one of the best college quarterbacks in the history of football.
There's a quarterback he reminds me of, and it's, you know,
Tebow or Burrow?
No, Burrow. But
I think it reminds me of Ryan Fitzpatrick. I think Devon Godshaw had an accurate. I mean, Devon Godshaw in an interview was talking about the two, and he was like, you know, he reminds me a lot of Fitzpatrick here, and he's right.
Pete Thamel wrote a fascinating story about how Urban Meyer essentially abuses quarterbacks when they first join to toughen them up, and when they get to Ohio State, toughen them up. And his name was John Burrow. They called him John as a kind of just to knock him down a peg or two, and he was in behind JT Barrett and Haskins and Cardale Jones, and the sort of the levels of abuse, not in a bad way necessarily, but the levels of abuse that Meyer gave, said he wasn't good enough, he should be playing like Division III football at Mount Union. And then JT Barrett turned to him and said, oh, don't worry, I was told I should be playing Appalachian State. And Cardale Jones said, oh, don't worry, I was told I should be playing at, you know, Hackensack University or whatever. But it's a fascinating story showing his resentment. And his dad was a coach. His dad was a coach for many, many years. Mm-hmm. Coached at a really high level, then came as a defensive coordinator under Frank Solich at Ohio to finish his career. It's a really fascinating story. It's well worth having a look at. It's on Pete Thamel's Twitter. He's the Yahoo college football writer. It's a really interesting tale about how Burrow's got to where he is now.
Yeah, I came away extremely impressed. Like I said, you know, I'm not comparing him as a player to Tim Tebow, but it felt like a Tim Tebow game. One of those tidal waves where there's nothing you can do.
Yeah, you know? he felt unstoppable at times, didn't he?
Yes. You know, it was overwhelming, and I said so on Twitter, and I still feel that way. I think he won on Saturday.
The one thing I was disappointed with was that the run at the end where he faked and took it himself for the first down, the kind of a critical first down on the last touchdown drive, and he just held the ball up and dropped it like a mic drop. And what I wanted him to do was the Desmond Howard Heisman celebrate, you know, just the little sort of the statue there at that point. That would have been just the, like, could you imagine the meltdown that happened?
No, and he also has his signature play, a huge conversion where he fakes the quarterback draw and then hits the in cut at the end of the game. That was a huge signature play. And of course, icing the game, you know, with the run.
Before we go as well, can we just have one word for Ryan Tannehill, who again was outstanding yesterday?
God, was he great.
Two drives at the end of the game to drive them down for a field goal and then to drive them down for the Adam Humphries touchdown, which, you know, he was getting absolutely destroyed in the pocket, and then destroyed Ryan Thornhill on the 2-point conversion to barrel over him to win the game. You know, kudos to Ryan Tannehill. As Peter King wrote this morning, one of the NFL's good guys had his third big day for the Titans. I mean, he's 3-1 as a start,
and two comebacks in the fourth quarter.
Kudos for him.
I mean, the comebacks are.
And struggling as well, because I know that his wife's father passed away last week as well. So he's doing all this with a heavy heart. So kudos to our former quarterback.
Yeah, it'd be something if he wills that team into the playoffs,
wouldn't it?
We traded him for what, a fifth round,
fourth rounder,
and we gave up like $7 million to grease the wheels.
Yeah.
Ouch.
All right.
It's time for Monday Night Football.
Yes. This is a meaty episode. We gave you well over an hour, people. Enjoy. Download it. Remember to always subscribe. Rate. Okay. There's talking in the background.
No, it's me. I put the football on. Okay. Did you just say rape? Or rape would have been weird.
We're gonna, you know what? That's it. Wednesday, we're giving you a vegan episode.
Yeah, Wednesday, you're not gonna get much. Wednesday, we're gonna say Bills, Dolphins, go, and then I'm gonna cut it off like 5 minutes into the episode.
It's fair enough.
That's my kind of episode. Make sure to do the commercials.
Mine too.
That's it. 99. There's no more. We will talk to you guys later on this week.
Thanks for listening to 3 Yards Per Caddy. You can subscribe via iTunes, on Podbean, or your usual podcast provider.